Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Rob Kress. Rob is founder and CEO of Waypost Advisors, who specializes in mid-market supply chain strategy. On the podcast, we take a deep dive into the U.S.-China trade war. Our conversation explores the challenges and opportunities for mid-market businesses in today's difficult environment, and how the trade war could impact the U.S. industrial sector and U.S. industrial real estate. If you're interested in industrial real estate and supply chain strategy, today's podcast is well worth a listen.
Rob, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gordon. Looking forward to it.
So, what got you into the whole space of logistics, supply chains, and kind of understanding how trade moves?
So I spent most of my career working at very large international corporations, running businesses, had supply chain reporting up into me. And one thing I kept seeing over and over throughout my career when we would work with smaller and call it mid-sized companies is they just lacked the resources and expertise that the very large companies had around their supply chain, basically their supply chain resources. And so I started Waypost 5 years ago, actually, with the idea being that we would bring that expertise to these mid-sized businesses that may not either be able to afford it or just don't have the size of the staff they need to tackle some of these global and then frankly domestic initiatives that they're seeing, whether it's inventory or supply chain risk or logistics, warehouse, or even do a lot of work around optimizing ERP systems. And so we're a little bit unique in that we focus 100% on execution. And so we come in, bring an experienced resource. My whole team comes from industry. Average experience is about 20 years. And we take that large company learnings and tailor it for mid-market size companies, because we also recognize that mid-sized businesses don't operate the same way as Fortune 50 companies, nor should they. And so we come in with solutions that work for them.
What are some of the unique ways that mid-sized companies operate versus Fortune 50 companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's the mid-sized companies and how we define the middle market is really companies less than $1 billion in revenue, so still good sized companies, but I would say it's a constant allocation of scarce resources, right? I mean, there's as these companies are growing and they're scaling. And this is where where we come in. Companies start stubbing their toe because they're trying to operate as if they were still a $50 million company, but maybe now they're a $300 million company. And so, they might not have anybody on their team that understands these processes. So if you're in a big company and hey, we need this position. We're starting this new initiative. These big companies sometimes can throw money at it and say, hey, well, we're just going to hire the team. We're going to hire people. Where mid-sized companies don't always have that luxury. And quite honestly, their payroll budgets are such that, if you're a high-ranking expert at a large company, it can be tough if you're a mid-sized company to lure those people away. So I think mid-sized companies, I think, have to be a little bit more scrappy by nature.
And what kind of lessons have you learned from those operators that make, we understand some of the problems, but what are some of the solutions that you've provided mid-sized companies that are unique solutions that like a Fortune 50 company wouldn't even consider?
So I think that so the biggest thing we do is really help them build capabilities and get stuff done, as we say. So, you know, a company might have, you know, call it an opportunity with let's just say inventory, right? They have too much inventory, maybe not enough of the right inventory. They're experiencing customer backlogs. Or we hear this a lot. My procurement team is just placing orders. They're not strategic. And so what we do is we not only come in and solve that problem that they're feeling for that pain point, but we help build capabilities internally. So then they can go on and do it themselves. And so, you know, we're very cognizant of the fact that, you know, these companies don't want a third party in there forever. You know, they want to be able to do it themselves and grow. And a lot of it is, you know, they haven't seen it before. And so, whereas a large company, you know, again, might hire a new head of whatever, head of supply chain to come in and drive organizational change, you know, from a strategic level, we're very much on the boots on the ground level in driving that change from the bottom up. Because again, these, you know, mid-sized companies don't need they don't need someone to come in and be a delegator. They need someone to come in and be a doer and help them figure out how to do it better.
So when you're talking about strategizing, one of the big things we'd like to focus on today is the strategy of de-risking supply chains. And so I'm curious, what are the key strategies that a middle market company can take to look at diversifying their supplier base and kind of mitigating some of those long-term risks?
Yeah, it's interesting right now. I would say in today's environment, there's not necessarily a silver bullet, but there are plenty of best practices that we're advising folks on. And so, and the reason I say there's no silver bullet is let's just take the example of, you know, you have a, let's just say all of your supply comes out of China, right? And you're very concerned from either a cost perspective or a geopolitical risk perspective, which are all very, very valid. We are advising clients and working with clients to help them find alternative sources outside of China. I mean, the reality is for some industries, it's just not feasible to have 100% U.S. production. You know, textile, a lot of packaging. I mean, the list goes on and on. But, you know, all that being said, it comes down to, you know, kind of some basics, right? Are you sole sourced on your key raw materials? Do you have internal metrics in place to track your inventory? So we have a lot of companies with what they, you know, their PSYOP, or it's basically a planning process, right? Are you buying enough, but not too much? And, you know, we see a lot of companies who don't really have a solid inventory and sales planning strategy. And so what that really results in is, you know, yeah, everything you bring in, you pay a tariff on today. And, you know, it's about how do you mitigate those internal costs to offset some of these increasing costs? So you kind of get your house in order, so to speak. But then from a risk standpoint, it really comes down to taking a look across your supply chain, starting to do the work for, you know, de-risking, which, you know, again, if you're having all your materials come in from China today, and you're looking at other countries, it's a long process, right? I mean, it's 6 to 18 months, depending on the industry, is not unreasonable. And there's typically an investment that goes along with that. And so what we're also seeing today is because of the massive uncertainty out there just with this whole tariff thing, right? What's going to happen? A lot of companies are doing nothing. They're choosing not to invest. They're choosing not to hire in some cases. And so they're in a bit of a wait and see mode and trying to figure out how much of that, of those cost increases, they can then pass on to their customers.
So when we talk about what companies are doing besides the wait and see mode, which I'm seeing a lot of there's a lot of our clients that they're not buying, they're not selling, they're not leasing, they're not doing anything. They're just waiting to see. In terms of that, one of the things that I think for those companies that are taking action, are there ways that they can balance some of that resiliency with efficiency, or is it a one or the other kind of option?
No. I think there's, I would say, especially in the middle market where we focus, and we focus primarily in manufacturing and distribution. So you kind of need a supply chain for us to be much value to you. But what we're seeing is now a really big push on improving operational efficiency. So the recognition that today it doesn't matter where you're getting your product from. If you're getting it from, even inside the US, costs have gone up. That's just period. And so the question is how do we mitigate those costs by operational improvements, right? So how do we get better internally? It's kind of like, you think of your own budget, right? Going through your personal budget, trying to figure out, okay, like what can I not just spend less on, but, how do I, even to the point of, I use your personal example, right? If you can burn less gas by working from home a couple of days a week, for example, then, that's more of a personal example. But I think, companies are looking at all kinds of ways like that how do we reduce our internal costs, our ongoing costs, to accommodate for these, for these tariffs. And I was going to mention layoffs. The middle market, we haven't seen a lot of layoffs. We've seen a lot of, people, like I said, delay hiring, but good people are hard to find. And so we haven't seen, at least I personally haven't seen, a lot of layoffs, from, especially in the manufacturing floor, because the reality is tradespeople are just about impossible to find. And so you're seeing kind of holding onto their people, and you don't see people switching as much, but you're also not seeing these mass recruitment efforts like you used to.
Do you have any good case studies of where you've kind of applied some of these rules to businesses to de-risk? I know we've been talking in generalities, but even if you don't name companies directly, are there any specific examples you could give of an effective de-risking policy?
Yes. So a couple examples. So we work with, it was actually a medical device company, and they buy or purchase a lot of their materials out of Asia. And so it was, I would say Asia still, they really produce a lot of the, lower value raw materials, I'm going to call it, right? And in this case, it was a catheter-like product. So, tubing, things like that, but medical grade. And so we started working with them on how do we de-risk their China supply chain? And they were concerned not just from a cost standpoint, but also from a geopolitical risk standpoint. A lot of uncertainty around that, right? And so, we started working with them on basically helping them explore options of where else could they get this product made. And so that was a good example of, their team was so busy keeping the business running, they didn't really have the resources to focus on this or the expertise. And so we came in to try to find them alternative suppliers outside of China. And we have, the folks at our team have the experience to do that. But I think the challenging, or one of the challenges is, and I think everybody who's tried this has seen this, the reality is China is inexpensive compared to the rest of the world. So, in this case, even going to Thailand, for example, was something like a 30% increase compared to China. And coming back to the US was, 200% increase. And so in this example, some of the work we're doing is that, kind of that buy versus make analysis, whereas, so one option, folks are looking at in this case too was, okay, should we just in-house the production of this? But the reality is that the expense of doing that in this case, wasn't justifiable. And so it came down to, and this is what we're seeing was kind of over and over is kind of this dual supply chain strategy, right? Because the thought is that, okay, something with tariffs probably will get figured out with China. It's probably going to be more expensive. So we still should keep our China source, but like in this case, you know, but we're going to explore this secondary thing. And, you know, in this case, let's just say Thailand, right? Whereas, you know, so we have dual sources. And so if there is a geopolitical event, let's just say with China, we already have something established. And that is a great example of what we're seeing a lot of companies do around kind of around that de-risking is, okay, what's my plan B in case my plan B needs to become my plan A as well. And yep. The reality is there's, you know, there's a higher cost associated with that. And then, you know, and then that we're starting to see that kind of trickle down into the consumer space too.
Are there some effective strategies to mitigate some of those higher costs, or is it just, a generally case by case basis?
So I would say universally, everybody has gone back to their supplier and saying, hey, let's partner on this. And so I've seen many cases specifically of suppliers saying, okay, we're gonna forego this price increase. We're gonna work with you. We're gonna kind of share the cost on some of this. But the reality is, in every situation with the level of the current tariffs, is it's just more expensive. And so there is, as far, not a scenario that we're seeing where you're going to completely mitigate cost increases, because, you know, let's just say, you know, even if, okay, so going to Thailand's 30% increase, but, you know, if the tariff out of China ends up being, I don't know what it's going to be, 50%, it's still, yeah. Right, it's still maybe a better option to go into Thailand. I think negating all of the cost increases related to tariffs, it's not possible right now. Now, with the exception of being, you know, we're seeing clients have a lot of luck identify that on the operations cost saving side. So, for example, we worked with an industrial client here in the Midwest, and, you know, we were able to looked at all of their trucking routes, and we call it network optimization. And so, you know, basically, are you using your supply chain network most efficiently, right? So do you have trucks going to the right locations, you know, not having to double back, et cetera? You know, what's the most efficient location? And through that work, we were able to save them something like $3 million. And so that's a good example of, you know, if you look at improving your supply chain operations, so after you receive the product, you know, your raw material, then you know, then we're seeing some significant savings there. But it's not easy, right? I mean, I'm talking like this is super easy, but this is a lot of work, and this is, you know, a lot of digging in, and you need the right expertise and focus to make these things happen.
So one of the things that the market's just generally been focused on, and there, I think you'll have a little bit of unique expertise in understanding some of this, is how companies have been leveraging AI and automation to kind of evaluate some of these gaps in their supply chain, just kind of what you just discussed. And I'm curious, have you seen AI and automation be applied as a way to kind of de-risk supply chains and maybe reduce some of the cost inefficiencies that exist for maybe more nearshore supply options? Is that something you're seeing?
Yeah, that's a great point. It absolutely is, especially on the automation side. And so, you know, and this started, you know, a few years ago when workers were just nowhere to be found. And so we have been seeing kind of across our client base a significant focus and investment into automation. So specifically manufacturing automation, you know, think robots, you know, that can take the place of some of these workers. Now it doesn't necessarily mitigate all of your supply chain risk, but what it does do is, especially when you're, you know, the folks who are looking to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., you know, they're looking heavily at automation solutions, because, you know, if they can make an upfront capital investment that'll pay back, they don't have to worry about trying to find labor and et cetera. Because, you know, the reality is that manufacturing, like skilled manufacturing labor is still very hard to find in the U.S. And so we're seeing a lot of interest in the automation side. Now, when you talk about AI, I'm not talking about ChatGPT, and you know, it's more of machine learning and I would say data automation. We're seeing a lot of interest in that. I would say some investments. I feel like the larger companies are leading the way on that. The challenge that a lot of middle market companies face is the quality of their data just isn't up to snuff quite yet. For having a model, let's just say, you know, process it, because it's very much a garbage in, garbage out scenario. And so you have to make sure your data is organized and clean and et cetera before you get on that path. But, you know, we are seeing lots of examples where companies are, I would say, using some of this technology to even automate processes, whether that's invoicing or placing POs, you know, whereas before it was highly manual and you know, someone was double checking everything, and some of these were hand entered, right? Well, we've seen examples of companies automating that to kind of remove that human element, and then being able to deploy their people on all higher value tasks and jobs, and that investment for things like that, I feel like it's coming down every day, and so that's very reachable for a lot of middle sized companies.
Yeah. Talking about other reachable issues for middle-sized companies, there's certainly a lot of barriers to automation. How have you seen companies navigate some of those barriers using some of the technology that you've mentioned?
Gordon, could you maybe go a little bit deeper with that question? Like what?
Yeah. So I know you mentioned some of the challenges that exist with data and some of the challenges that exist with automation. And I know that we've gone in with clients that are dealing with greenfield and brownfield automation of their technology, particularly some of the folks that are on the manufacturing and distribution side. And I'm curious if you've seen anything unique in terms of, you know, barriers that middle market companies experience versus larger companies, and kind of how that plays out in terms of applying technology to automate processes, and if there are efficient ways that they can get through that process.
I see. Okay, thank you. I think that the barriers that I'm seeing really revolve around that, going back to that resource question. So if you're a large company, you know, you probably have a group, a division, you know, whatever, focused on your IT and your AI. Whereas, you know, if you're a mid-sized company, you're probably not hiring AI strategist, right? And so a lot of these things are I find kind of homegrown in some ways. Not everything, right? And now the good news is there's, I would say, a lot of companies starting up out there to help these mid-sized companies figure out their way, almost be kind of bring some of that strategy and problem solving to the table. But I think it's, you know, beyond the data, I just think it's a lot of these companies don't know where to start, right? It's like, hey, yeah, this sounds neat, this sounds cool, or I think all these seminars and everything on AI haven't done some of these companies many favors, because it feels like everyone is kind of AI to death a little bit, and all you hear about is ChatGPT, and look, you can make this cool video. And I think some of these CEOs are sitting back saying, okay, great, but I don't really know what that does for my company. Right? And so,
yeah.
So I think having that knowledge base of what AI can do for your company is one of the biggest hurdles that we've seen. And some companies are reluctant to get into that space because, you know, they're looking for a return on their investment. Right. And it's still, you know, so sometimes it can be hard to quantify that depending on what the automation is. I mean, it's easy to say, hey, this is going to increase our output, or this is going to, you know, help us with headcount, et cetera, and calculate an ROI on that. But when you're just dipping your toe into it and you're like, oh, I'm not really sure, like, do I want to spend all this money trying to figure it out? I don't know.
There's a lot of snake oil salesmen out there.
There really are, unfortunately.
You know, I feel like this, and look, I wasn't around for it, but reading so many books on it, like the early ages of the internet, where it's very hard to determine who's the Amazon and who's the pets.com of the AI community. It's just challenging. Do you have any advice for people who are kind of applying products or bringing in consultants to kind of detect some of that snake oil sales that's happening in the AI world?
Absolutely. I would ask for a couple of things. Ask for specific examples of work they've done. Ask for references of similar companies. Yeah. Because to your point, I mean, it feels like half the people I talked to were AI experts and okay. But have you actually done the work at a similar company? Do you have, again, you have a reference? And I think anybody who's not willing to at least take a little bit of time, you know, again, a few hours, and not charge you anything and sit down with you and say, hey, look, here's how I think I can help you. I don't think it's, you know, if they're pushing for a, hey, just sign on the dotted line and then we'll get to work. I mean, I'd be a little bit careful of that. And if anyone who kind of makes it sound like too good to be true.
So one of the things that sometimes can seem too good to be true, but I think is an actual real strategy moving forward, is there are a lot of companies out there that can build cultures very effectively around the idea of continuous improvement in operations. I know for us and for our business, we are regularly doing, at the very least, monthly and sometimes bi-monthly seminars and strategy sessions where we go through our procedures and our operations and try to improve efficiency. In terms of that, I'm curious, do you have any strategies beyond AI that companies can generally apply to try to work on continuous improvement in their processes and their operations?
Absolutely. So I'm a big believer that AI is a tool. It is not, it's not culture. It is not what's going to drive continuous improvement. It's right. It is a tool to be utilized. And so if you're talking about culture and fostering that culture of, I'm going to call it innovation around improvement, it's really about finding, you know, one, it has to start from the top, right? So the leadership has to be championing the message of continuous improvement. And I think it's also being open to helping your employees find new ways to work. And so what we see over and over and over is, you know, teams, everybody's running lean right now, right? In terms of lean teams, everyone has a lot of work to do, kind of, you know, overwhelmed in some cases. So if you're going into a team who's already working umpteen hours a week, keeping the business running and saying, great, I have to make things better, guys, like, go. That doesn't work because, you know, people feel overwhelmed and people, this is a human nature, right? Change is hard. And so you have to make it easy for them. And so we specialize a lot on change management, or focus a lot on change management and our engagements for that reason. Because if you just come in and drop a new process and say, go, you know, that doesn't work. And so you have to give folks, show them the path to, you know, the promised land, so to speak, right? And this is how your life is going to get better. But I think it has to start with leadership and then putting people in place within the organization who have that improvement mentality of like, okay, I know we've been doing it like this for 20 years, but, you know, we're 15 times the size we were. That doesn't work anymore. How do we make it better so you're not spending all of your time in a spreadsheet? And so, you know, so I think it's that mentality. But going back to my earlier point, you may or may not be surprised by how many people who are just, I mean, they're just working so hard and they're trying really hard too, but they are so busy because they're stuck in these kind of old ways of doing things that they just don't have the, I would say, the bandwidth to try to think of anything new. And so you have to kind of take that pressure off a little bit. And nine times out of 10, it doesn't necessarily involve hiring more people. It's about, okay, like how do we develop better processes? So do kind of the initial push, show people that, hey, life is better, and then start them on that journey.
One of the things that I'd like to discuss that pertains very much to what we talk about regularly is, how do you think the world of logistics and trade and manufacturing that's shifting is going to change real estate and kind of the industrial real estate world about 10 years from now?
Good question. So I don't believe that you're going to see every manufacturer come back to the U.S. I think you're going to see a bigger interest and more of a push with the tariffs in place. But the reality is it's a global economy, and so. You know, I think that real estate from a couple perspectives, I do think you're going to continue to see investment in the U.S. And so things like industrial space and et cetera, I think you're going to see more of these things built. I think, you know, depending on who's in the next administration, what their policies are, I mean, pre-current administration, there was a massive build out in Mexico because that was one of the main de-risking strategies companies were taking to de-risk from China, because you didn't have the call it the ocean freight risk, and Mexico's right there, and it was still a much lower cost base than compared to the U.S. And so I would expect that to come back again, depending on what future policies entail. But I also think that more and more you're going to see more pressure for folks to return to the office, and this is not a personal opinion. This is what we're seeing from our clients and hearing from others is, you know, I think you know, as more and more people are expected to come back to the office, and so I think from a real estate perspective you're gonna see that materialize more and more, especially as companies look to invest in new facilities and you know, build their new office next to their new manufacturing plant. And so I think on the commercial real estate side, this is coming from a non-real estate guy, but I think you're going to see, you know, more of an increase. And I think companies, we're even seeing it now, they're getting, I would say everybody's really knowledgeable about tariffs right now and where to build the next facility, and things like incentives are really important, state by state. And so I think you're also going to see companies more willing to build other places across the U.S. to take advantage of some of those nuances.
So one of the nuances that we always like to talk about is kind of the nuanced perspective that every human being has. And we have a lot of younger listeners, and we'd be curious on your perspective on if you could travel back to the start of your career, what little tidbit of advice would you give a young Rob?
So you're saying I'm old.
Well, I'm old. I'm old too, to some of our listeners.
Which I am. So I would say a couple things. Be willing to learn. Like, raise your hand and recognize that. Especially for me, coming out of college, right? You think you know everything. The reality is, you know nothing, and so. Be willing to learn, raise your hand, ask questions, and probably the biggest piece of advice is listen more than you talk.
Like, that's the whole point of this podcast, is asking questions and listening to expert advice. So we truly appreciate that. There's one thing that we always appreciate as well, and that's kind of looking at potentially other ways that we can listen or read and learn a little bit about the world. And I'm curious if you have like a book or a podcast or something that we should listen to or read that would help inform us and learn a little bit more about the world?
So one book, and I think this has been very valuable to me, and I tell everybody, I recommend this book to everybody. It's Chris Voss's book called Never Split the Difference.
Yes, it's a great one.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's really at face value. Yeah, it's a negotiating book, but if you go deeper, it's really about that, you know, developing your empathy, which I think can serve a lot of folks well in life. And so just, you know, taking a moment to step back and try to take the emotion out of situations and think about it from the other person's perspective has been invaluable for me.
Yeah, I look, that's a book that we've had recommended before, and there's a reason for it. I mean, it's an excellent book on understanding the perspectives of others and kind of understanding how that plays out in the world of business. There's one thing in the world of business, though, that we won't let you get out of in this interview, and that's to understand who the next person that's influencing the world of trade and logistics and manufacturing that we should have on the podcast. It's the whole reason for the podcast, and we always find that the men and women in the arena tend to know the next best person to bring on. So who's that next person that we should ask to hop on the podcast?
So I have a great name for you. It's in fairness, they may be a competitor of yours. I don't know. But his name's Corey. He's with a company here in the Twin Cities called Brookshire. And the reason I bring it up is what they're doing is really neat in that they have this, I call it a series, but they go highlight these, call it very rural communities, because the intention is to help build community to get manufacturers and distributors to build facilities, bring jobs to these areas. But they actually go out and almost do kind of like a documentary in some of these areas. And it's, I would say the focus they have on kind of rural America and trying to help rural America is really neat. And I'm happy to make an introduction if it's useful.
Look, I would love that. In our business, we're all about making friends, and there's really no one who we would say is truly a competitor. So we're always happy to bring on other brokers, and we've done that from other shops in the past. So in terms of that, there's one last and final question that we'd love to ask you. It's going to be a little easier. It's just, what's the best way to get in contact with you if somebody listened to this podcast and wants to reach out?
Oh, I appreciate it. Feel free to visit us at waypostadvisors.com. It's WAYPOST advisors with an I.com. Happy to have a conversation if anybody wants to reach out.
Rob, thank you so very much for hopping on today, and we'd love to have you on in the future.
Thanks again to Rob. We appreciate his insights. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us to continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.